Good morning, everyone. Hello, hello. Welcome to breakout number one. How excited are we to be here today? Who woke up at a ridiculous hour this morning to get here? Woo! Well, I am glad we're here with you for breakout session number one. So hopefully you're still alert and the coffee's still kicking in. Good morning. My name is Kara Crickery. I'm with GSK, GlaxoSmithKline Pharmaceuticals. Woo! Go GSK! There's only about 1,000 of us here today, so you might see and hear us. We have a R&D, a research and development hub, about, on a good day, less than an hour from here, with 3,400 employees, and we are so proud to be a sponsor of today's event. At GSK, we take it very seriously when we encourage folks to be yourself, to embrace inclusion, diversity, and to be able to be true to who you are, whatever race, ethnicity, preferences that may be, religion, etc. And we're here this morning to talk to you about generations. At my dinner table on Monday evening, my nephew was in town, and I realized there were 5 generations at our dinner table. And I take that for granted when my parents are there, my brother-in-law, my 3-year-old daughter is there. But we work with different generations all the time, whether it's your family or your workplace, whatever it may be. And this morning, I am proud and privileged to be here with this powerhouse panel of women to talk multi-generational engagement and how you can make the most and be effective in your workplace. And I'm guessing you'll get some takeaways for in your family and your personal life as well. So I'm now going to introduce Lindsay Pollack, our lead speaker with us. Lindsay is a author, and she has a New York Times best-selling book. She's got 3 books. She's also worked for LinkedIn in the past, and she's got a new book, Remix. I highly recommend it. It's a great book. There's going to be a book signing at the end, actually, so she's going to skedoodle out of here. That's an official term, by the way, skedoodle. Thank you very much. For the book signing in the exhibit hall, so please go find her there after this session. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Lindsay. Good morning.
Thanks, Kara. Good morning, everyone. It is amazing to see all of you here. Thank you for choosing our panel when there's so much going on. We are so delighted to be here. My job is to kind of frame the topic of the multi-generational workplace, and then my panelists will answer some questions, and then we'll toss it all out to you. Sound good? Okay. So I want to talk about the state of affairs, why it matters, and what we're going to do about it. That's sort of my framing device for this session. And the state of affairs, as Kara mentioned, the headline is that we now, for the first time in American history, have 5 distinct generations in the workplace. This is new. We have the traditionalists or silent generation, the baby boomers, the Xers, the millennials, and now Generation Z, and I'll define those in a moment. So that's really new. What's new is not that we have young people coming into the workplace. Every single one of us has been a young person coming into the workplace. What has changed dramatically is how much longer people are working into their lives. So the expansion is happening on both ends. One statistic for you is that we have more Americans in the workforce age 85 and older than ever before in history. So the expansion is happening in every direction. This also means that we have different skill sets at every level and generation. So I know that when I started out in the 90s, I'm a Gen Xer, and I came into the workforce, I was ambitious and I was hardworking, but I didn't have any skills my boss didn't really have. Now, with millennials as the largest generation in the workforce and the first digital natives, and now the Gen Zs after them, the youngest person in the office walks in with a skill set that is really critical for us. So here's another scenario that is happening. 38% of Americans work for a boss who is younger than they are. 38%. So this has happened in the past, but not at the numbers we have. Look at the highest leadership job in our country, President of the United States. We have the largest age range, the widest age range of candidates for president than ever in American history. This is not something that happens every couple of years. Never before have we had such a wide gap. Who's the youngest person running for president, the first ever millennial to run for president? Pete Buttigieg is 37 years old. Who's the oldest? It's Bernie. I heard Bernie. Bernie Sanders is 78 years old. What that means is you have 2 people, 4 decades apart in age, applying for the same job. how do you compare apples to apples? So the five-generation workplace has created scenarios and situations that we have never had before. So next question, so what? Why does it matter? Age is just a number, right? When I think about generational differences, and I've been doing this work and research for about 17 years, it's not that we're fundamentally different people. I really believe that we all want many of the same things. What's different is that the times in which you grow up, the times in which you enter the workplace, I think impact your expectations about what work will be like. If you're entering financial services in 1950 as a woman, your expectation of who your colleagues will be is very different than a college graduate today, where 50% of her college classmates were women. She will expect the workplace to look like that. Think about technology. If you are a baby boomer, you expect that your work environment will have electricity, yes? A Generation Z, who's 22 and younger, is going to have different expectations. I will give you a personal example. I have an 8-year-old daughter. We went on vacation to lovely Maine this summer, and we walked into our hotel room in Maine, and into the air of the room, my daughter said, "Alexa, what's the weather?" So her expectation is that any room she walks into has a listening device. She will walk into your company and say, "Alexa, where's my 10 a.m. meeting?" Because her expectation is that that is what is available. So we're going to talk today not about how we're fundamentally different people, but about how expectations impact what we want from the workplace. And finally, what are we going to do about it? Kara mentioned my latest book is called The Remix. And the reason I chose that title is based on the idea of a remix in music, which we're all familiar with. A remix is a song, a classic, that has been changed or updated in some way to make it modern. And the metaphor of the remix in the workplace is that a remix doesn't say that the old classic song is bad or outdated or should retire. It says, huh, there are interesting ways to make this new and different. And I wasn't going to use the term remix without interviewing some DJs and music producers. Do we have any DJs or music producers in the room? Probably a handful. So I interviewed some DJs, and what they told me is remixes are incredibly popular. And they said one of the reasons remixes are so popular is if you're DJing a party and you have an empty dance floor, a little trick is to play a remix, because the older people at the party know the classic song and they feel included and come and dance. And the younger people know the remix modern version and they feel included and come and dance. So the theme for this panel is, how do we create remixes? How do we create environments, situations, communications, hiring strategies, retention programs, recruiting benefits? How do we create situations where everybody feels included together? So with that, while my panelists get ready, I thought it'd be really fun to both define the generations and share our ages with a bunch of random strangers in a room. So let's see what generations we have here today. I'm gonna define them, give you some time to think about what you wanna say, and then we can raise our hands for our generations. These are definitions according to the Pew Research Center, but I want you to feel free to raise your hand for the generation that you feel deep down inside, even if it's not the year you were born. And I also want you to feel free to just blatantly lie. Okay, so traditionalist silent generation, born before 1945. Do we have any traditionalist silent generation in the room? How many of you work with someone who's a member of the traditionalist or silent generation? Okay, thank you. Baby boomers, born 1946 to 1964. Baby boomers, great. Woodstock, okay. Gen Xers, 1965 to 1980. Welcome, my people. A lot of reluctant hands going up. Millennials, 1981 to 1996. Generation Y is a synonym for millennials, so you're here both of those. And Generation Z, born 1997 and later. Welcome, Gen Z, thank you. Has anyone heard they have named the next generation who have not yet been born? So we're out of letters. Anyone? They're calling them Generation Alpha. So I think Kim has a Generation Alpha along with her on the stage. With that, I want to thank you again for joining us. I'm going to ask Delilah to kick us off. You have everybody's full bios. I asked each of the speakers to give just a quick introduction, and then I'll ask them some questions. Delilah.
Thank you, Lindsay. Well, good morning. My name is Delilah Wilson Scott, and I work for Comcast NBC Universal. I head up our community impact function. Philly is our global headquarters. So for those of you who are not from Philly, welcome. Hopefully Philly is treating you well, but excited to be here today. And thanks, Lindsay, for bringing a lot of your expertise to the space.
Good morning, I'm Nicole Gold. I am a vice president of operations at Independence Blue Cross. I live here in Philadelphia.
Look at your fans.
I have a fan club here today. I'm also a Center City working mom living right here in Center City, Philadelphia.
I'm Kim Lear. I'm a researcher. My background is in demography and sociology. I study this topic. A long time ago, my undergrad research was exclusively around baby boomers and longevity. So when Lindsay is talking about people working longer, redefining that, that was a lot of my research. And then my master's was more around social media and its impact on politics. At the time, it was the Obama-McCain campaign, so things have changed quite a bit in terms of that topic. And I work with organizations on this topic and academic institutions on research on generations.
Thank you. So Delilah, I want to start with you. Here we are at a women's conference. We've mentioned being mothers. We've mentioned all these different identities. And you can't really separate out a generation from all these other aspects of identity. We talk about it as intersectionality. Can you define that term and talk about how intersectionality impacts this conversation about generational differences?
Sure. I mean, you laid out sort of the context for our conversation today, and there are obviously similarities among multiple generations. But just to use myself as an example, yes, I'm a Gen Xer, woohoo! And I'm a woman, so obviously there's affinity there and in alignment with today's conference. I'm also an African-American woman, so woman of color, working mother, mother of three, et cetera. So there are going to be traits that I have as a woman of color that will be aligned with a white woman or an African-American man, but there are many traits that are specific to my experience as a woman of color. So when we think about a multi-generational workplace, it's not just, you can no longer look at inclusion from one lens, you know, generation lens or gender lens. Inclusion includes so many different communities, and I think we just have to really expand our thought process and recognize that, again, while we may share many different common thoughts because we're women or because we're mothers, that we have some unique experiences that we bring to the table outside of that.
So as a follow-up to that, what do you think are the unique experiences of women related to the multi-generational workplace?
Sure. I mean, one on women, specifically on, I'll speak to women of color. So a lot of people talk about gender equity and pay equity and what that means and how do we close that gap. But there are many efforts that are pro-women that aren't necessarily inclusive of what I might be experiencing as a woman of color. So the pay equity, the equity gap in general for most women, most white women in the country is about 77 cents. When you look at 77 cents to a dollar that a man would earn. For Latina, right, it's 56%, and African-American women are in the middle. So, you know, there is a different gap I'm trying to close. I'm still just trying to get to where white women are. And sometimes there's not necessarily enough empathy for that viewpoint. And I think sometimes when, you know, all women get into the room, it can often be the conversation, the objectives and the direction of that conversation can be led by whoever's, you know, the dominating voice, as opposed to have we really thought about, does this, you know, impact, you know, Lindsay the same way it impacts me? Or is she hearing me? Am I sharing my perspective so that she understands, well, this might be nice, it doesn't necessarily work for me. One specific example, I'm a member of, you know, a prominent women's organization, and we were hosting an event, and it was a male speaker, but an African-American male speaker. So I was excited as a woman of color that we would diversify who we were choosing to speak, but there were many other women in that room who felt offended because it was a male speaker. So that's like a perfect example of, you know, I was experiencing that as a woman of color and being proud of that moment, and then, you know, have to take step back, understanding her perspective, but also making sure she understood mine.
You know, it's funny, people often ask me in my work, Kim, I'm sure you get this too, well, like, what's the one speaker who would have been perfect? There is no one person who sort of applies to every single person right. feeling mm-hmm. they're represented. So, Nicole, you manage, I think, 800 people, is that correct? Mm-hmm. So you are dealing with this, and I'd love for you to give some context of the team that you manage and mm-hmm. this complexity and diversity. What are some tactical, practical things that any of us can do to team build and build community when you have all these different interests on a team?
Yes. I have all five generations on my team at Independence. And absolutely, there's a lot of intersectionality as well. And our focus is really on figuring out how to partner and team some of our employees together towards the best outcome. So I may have some team members who are millennials or Gen Z, and some team members who have a little bit more experience and are perhaps a baby boomer or the traditionalists. And what I find is it is really important to make an effort to partner people towards some common outcome you're trying to achieve. So it might be a project, it might be a short-term assignment. It's really good to look at how can you take people who may have different experience levels and bring them together. And then one thing, if you're in a situation in your workplace where you're trying to figure out how can I get my team members who span all these generations to maybe bond and become a stronger team, one thing that I have found really, really helpful is a volunteer effort. Like, get off site, go volunteer at MANA or something, and it really brings the team together across all the generations. I don't know if you other ladies have seen that too, but it's definitely something that our team members are asking for.
Yeah, I think that idea of people working together towards a greater mission, whether that's in your company or on a volunteer mm-hmm. effort or even a political campaign, is another very multi-generational environment. Mm-hmm. When people are focused not on how different we are, but on achieving a common goal,
yes.
that's really powerful. So Kim, we often lump together millennials and Gen Zs, right, as those young people who can use their phones properly, yeah. right?
Millennials are 40, by the way, so I love that. They're like the young people.
Yes, 40 is young, my friend. Okay, so... Yeah. Let's parse out millennial and Gen Z. This morning had someone come up to me when I was at the Breakfast with Comcast who said, oh, I thought anyone under 40 was a millennial. So they're very different, and we're just starting to see this change. So can you talk us through the differences between millennials and Gen Z? Pew defines them as being cut off around 1996, 1997. So can you tell us your perspective on that?
Yeah, so I conduct a series of focus groups and interviews on 32 college campuses and with 14 school districts with high school seniors. And so I have noticed a lot of differences. What I particularly look at is the intersection between sociology and history. So trying to understand the events and conditions that shape our formative years. And so one of the bigger differences that I'm noticing between millennials and Gen Z are the impacts of the 2008-2009 housing crisis and recession and the hangover from that. And you know, part of that is Gen Z growing up with this backdrop of extreme income inequality and kind of how that plays out. And then one of the things that I'm hearing in the focus groups with Gen Z, some of what I hear is very much what I would expect to hear with the generation who grew up with that type of economic volatility. Mm-hmm. But some of what I hear sort of surprised me. And one of the things that surprised me is how often they talk about their millennial siblings. And so they'll say things like, I idolized my older sister. I totally thought she was going to graduate college and go and change the world. She graduated college. There were no jobs. She moved back home. She was living at home in her childhood bedroom. And I'll basically do whatever I can for that to not happen to me. And so there does seem to be this greater focus on stability. When I'm interviewing hiring managers today, they're telling me that Gen Zers are coming in and asking questions that millennials, we weren't asking upon entrance into the workplace. So very specific questions around 401k matching programs, around benefits packages, around your track record, around loyalty to your people. And so I think that that will be one of the big differences that we see. And with recruitment messaging, I mean, recruitment is a sales job. And essentially the sales message to millennials was typically a lot about impact, a lot about meaning, you know, what does this job really provide for you in those ways, where I think that the this recruitment sell is going to be quite different with Gen Z, more pragmatic, more realistic, more financially focused. So that would be
yeah. So interesting that one generation reacts to the other. Yeah. Are those of you in the audience just hands seeing that, a difference between the millennials and the Gen Zs? Yeah, yeah, interesting. Thank you for that. So Nicole, on your team, you have to communicate with all these different generations. Mm-hmm. You've talked about team building.
Yes.
How do you, and again, is there one communication method that everybody mm-hmm. wants? How do you possibly communicate to some people who want text messages, some people who want face-to-face, some people who want paper? How do you handle that with a large team? Mm-hmm.
Well, we really focus on having one message and then many different ways to communicate it. It could be message board, digital boards, texting. It could be instant messaging, voicemails, but also face-to-face. A lot of our team members want the option to get face-to-face with leaders and hear the messaging and have it be a two-way dialogue, not a one-way conversation. And so the leaders in my organization, on my team, we have to focus on not just the organized communication that goes out to everyone, but also how can we connect one-on-one with people, either like at a breakfast setting, or honestly, sometimes we walk the floor and hand something out to every person so that you can really connect with them and leave some space to have a conversation if they want to have it.
Management by walking around.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So Kim, a lot of the leaders dealing with this now are millennials. You've talked about millennials are on the verge of turning 40, mm-hmm. are in a lot of leadership positions. Do you see differences in how millennials are approaching leadership compared to other generations?
Yeah, and part of what I love about Lindsay's work is looking at some of the things that are consistent throughout the generations. And so in my focus groups, one of the questions that I always ask of leaders is, what is the most difficult part of leading? And there's a lot of consistency there. It kind of boils down to like, people are weird, and the things like the things that they want and the things that motivate them, you know, and so that there's a lot of consistencies. I would say one of the things that has been really interesting is to look at how it was as millennials were entering the workplace where the authentic self movement really moved from academia mm-hmm. into the workplace. And this was that whole idea of bring your whole self to work. And so from younger leaders, I do hear a lot about, you know, I have a difficult time finding that line between friend and friendly. Mm-hmm. And how can I be part of the team while still maintaining a role of authority? And so I think that that's going to be something interesting to watch over the next mm-hmm. 5 years of how do you balance this big pressure around authenticity, bringing your whole self to work, but then there are some natural boundaries that have to occur. And then the other thing that's making that line a little blurry is that millennials statistically are getting married later, having children later. And so for previous generations, if you were a 34-year-old manager and you were managing people between 23 and 27, there was sort of a natural difference in life stage where you might have had a mortgage to pay and kids and a husband or wife, where they were single and dating and going out more, where now there's more lifestyle similarities between a 27-year-old and a 34-year-old, which also creates some of that blurry line. And so I don't have a, like, here's exactly what you do about that, but I think that that's just something that we're looking at studying to try to understand how a new generation who walked into the workforce during the authenticity movement redefines how you show up as your true self while still maintaining those boundaries and being a person of authority.
Thank you, Nicole.
I want to invite you to come to my office because we definitely have those challenges where leaders really have a challenging time adjusting the idea that if you're my supervisor, Delilah, you're not my friend. We can be friendly, but there, I do find that our team members really have a difficult time figuring out where the line is crossed and where they need to, be more professional. And what I have found is, honestly, people cross the line, and then that is the opportunity to quickly coach, to try to bring people back and let them know if they've experienced it once, then you can coach them so they don't do it again.
So the word friend came up, which mm-hmm. now is sort of a trigger to talk about Facebook and social media and the digital piece mm-hmm. of this, which is that we have the reality that's going on here, but how many of you are tweeting or Instagramming? This is my good side, by the way, for Instagram. there's a whole nother reality going on. So would one of you comment mm-hmm. on how that is impacting these situations? When I entered the workforce, there was no social media. Mm-hmm. And now it's an integral part of what we do. Delilah, will you talk about that?
Sure. And I'll talk about it from a couple different perspectives. I think what we all need to realize is technology and just the advent of social media, there's so many more messages that scale faster. And many individuals or collective of individuals have a platform and a voice to share a message that they didn't before. But the truth of the matter is, the majority of people who are living below the poverty line, whether you're in an urban market or rural market, you don't actually have access to technology. And so that exacerbates income inequality. And you know, you sort of just have to be thoughtful about that. People think about not having access to their phone, but there are many people who don't have access to basic technology, mm-hmm. Which is one of the things we focus on a lot. But I think, again, technology sort of gives voice to individuals in a way that possibly only institutions had before. It also sort of forces a more instant response and instant expectation. So if you think about all the CEOs who are making statements and taking social actions, that wouldn't have happened 20 years before, right? Maybe an incident happened, you know, if we reference the Starbucks incident that happened here in Philly not too long ago, that would have happened. Maybe there would have been a message, and, you know, someone would have put together a very refined memo to the CEO, to comms, what do we do? That would have taken weeks, and then there, you know, would have been internal decision. That hit social media instantly. People, whether you were in Philly or not, enrage people, you know, on both sides of the issue, and they immediately had to respond. That's a new, you know, sort of element that didn't happen before. But we also know that social media creates filter bubbles, whether it's by generation or other affinity groups. And so you have to really be careful of all that background AI working for something you might think is an authentic experience, when actually, you know, it's not the reality. And I do think, you know, technology never replaces a true offline relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, some people who have the most friends and likes in social media are very lonely people when you meet them in person. So I think it's just, you know, helpful to know. I don't know that it's another reality, but it's definitely another observation and perception.
Like Kim, I do a lot of focus groups with millennials and Gen Zs, and what they tell me all the time is, can you please tell other generations that we do want to talk face-to-face? Mm-hmm. People assume because we're young that we only want to use mm-hmm. technology. Please make sure that that message gets across, and that maybe in the digital world it's even mm-hmm. more important to
Absolutely.
Have those one-on-one relationships. That brings us, I think, to the conversation of mental health, right, and loneliness mm-hmm. and disconnection. The rates of mental health needs and issues among millennials and Gen Zs are off the charts. If anyone's here from universities, I go to campuses and I say, hey, what's going on? And mental health is the first answer on every campus. Kim, can you talk about how that is bubbling up, maybe why it's happening so much with millennials? It's certainly always been an issue, but even more so with millennials. And how is that entering the workplace conversation?
Sorry, I went off
script. Oh, yeah.
Sorry. No, I'm like, was this question ready?
Yeah.
You know what? I'm still actually kind of trying to figure out how I want to articulate my perspective on this, because I'm not a mental health professional. I have no background in psychology. And so I hesitate just because I have nothing, I feel like, particularly meaningful to say on the topic or helpful. But I mean, it comes up all the time. Obviously, the reasons that we see it in different parts of the country, they come up for different reasons. So I did a series of focus groups at the school in Utah that has the highest rate of teen suicide. And it's mostly within the LGBTQ community, which would make sense with some of the things happening between the Church of the Latter-day Saints and the gay population and things like that. So I think it's very kind of region specific on what we're seeing. And then, I mean, the research is very split on why we're seeing this. Jean Twenge, who I'm sure you're familiar with, in her book, iGen, she attributes a lot of it to tech. And for a lot of reasons. One is comparison and people feeling you know, not good enough. Part of it is just young people between gaming and social media, they're just spending a lot of time inside, which that can contribute to rates of anxiety and depression. But there are a lot of other ideas as well. I mean, there are some linguists who are actually wondering if this also has to do with the familiarity with the language, where there were a lot of young people in the 70s and 80s and 90s who maybe also felt these feelings of anxiety and depression, but they didn't have the terminology to explain it. So a 13-year-old in 1980
might have felt feelings of anxiety but didn't know the word anxiety. And so it's hard to trace. So from a perspective of longitudinal studies, it's hard to understand exactly how it's changed. But, you know, so part of it, I think, is vernacular and just the way we use language. And I'm sure some of it is tech mixed with so many other issues that are coming up now. So
thank you. That's very helpful perspective. Delilah, again, going back to intersectionality, and now we add mental health to the picture, how have you taken efforts to empathize with other generations? What's your advice to everyone who says, well, oh, I want to learn more about this, or I want to build more connections? I think there's some statistics. It's highly unlikely to have a friend who's more than 10 years older or younger than you are. You have family members, you have colleagues, but to actually have friends of different generations is actually quite rare. So how do you build these bridges and empathize across generations? I'd love to hear your perspective.
I mean, I do think, obviously, it's an important trait, and I'm so thrilled it's called out more now as a trait that is viewed as a positive as it relates to leadership. Just like authenticity in the movement Kim mentioned, sort of 10, 20 years ago, that is not what was taught in B schools and other places about what you wanted to be as a leader. It was like you want to be a perfect sort of pulled together package, and now it's much more about being yourself. And I think empathy is a part of that, and quite frankly, I think it's a place where women can excel. I mean, it's a basic concept, and I'm a mother. I have three children. They're 8, 11, and 13. And I will say, kids can teach you empathy in a way that you know, you can make you really appreciate it. But it really is taking that moment to step outside of your own shoes to see how someone else is dealing with something. What might be the right decision, the fair decision, absolutely what we should do as a business, is not going to impact every single person on your team the same way. And I do think you have to step outside a bit to say, you know, one, don't assume, right? So let's not make assumptions about people because of their generation or race or gender or whatever it may be. You really sort of have to get to know people on an individual level, and that makes a difference even when you're delivering a really tough message. And then I also think, it's helpful for me to dig into something where I didn't feel heard, where I didn't feel like I had a voice at the table. And when I put myself in that position, then it's easier for me to say, okay, when I'm on the other side of the table, what can I do to make people feel included? But you can never over-empathize, right? It sort of doesn't exist. But I think ask, don't assume, step outside of your comfort zone, and make sure you're doing that often enough. And taking those risks. You know, it can feel scary to you know, ask or be in a mentorship relationship with somebody who feels like they seem like they have nothing in common with you. But those are gonna be your big learning moments. But I do think it's something you have to constantly remind yourselves of, right? It's so easy to sort of think through, oh, I'm just gonna hang out with, you know, the working moms at my office. Well, that doesn't necessarily make me a better person or an effective leader. So I really have to ask myself, like, what's that blind spot I have? Or is this a moment I need to advocate for a white male that maybe I just completely missed giving my perspective?
I like what you said about having regular reminders. I have a quotation over my desk from Voltaire: common sense is not so common. And everybody sees it very differently. And my little trigger for that is, do you ever find yourself thinking generationally or just individually or about your child, what were they thinking? My trigger is to then stop and say, what were they thinking? Like, because I really don't think anyone walks into the office in the morning and says, I want to dress as inappropriately as possible, right?
No.
Maybe occasionally people do, but what were they thinking? Oh, they were trying to dress appropriately. They thought that was okay. Maybe this is a coachable moment. And so it's those moments where you think, wow, what were they doing that can be really triggering? So, Nicole, amid all of this, you have to get things done, and we have to be profitable or achieve our goals as a business. How do you leverage and not treat generational differences as a problem to be solved, but how have you been able to use this as an opportunity to build and grow people? What's been your experience as a leader?
I mean, my experience has been when you take team members from different generations and you bring them together and you're clear about what you want to achieve, you're clear about your company's values, that they really can leverage each other's strengths. I have absolutely had situations where I have millennials and Gen Z team members who have some creative ideas and they're excited about them, and we want to make them happen. At the same time, I've had a baby boomer on the team, and it was really important for that baby boomer to share, hey, let's think through some of the things that could go wrong here, because she's been through it and they hadn't. And if I didn't have the baby boomer at the table to have those conversations, then we might have been done something a little bit too edgy, and instead could find something creative that also aligned with who we are, our brand, and what we wanted to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. You are one of the few people I've met who has quite a few Silent Generation team members.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about managing that fifth mm-hmm. generation that is a minority of the workplace, but certainly yeah. still here, and some examples of that?
Yeah, it's really exciting. One thing I would really like to share about that is we tend to, in the media, have all these stereotypes about the different generations. But one thing that I have observed, and we're seeing it real time on my team, is that I have Silent Generation and Baby Boomer team members who are right there with the millennials and the Gen Zs around professional development and growth. If we have internal programs that people can apply for to grow professionally and personally. They're applying for them, they're getting in. And just the idea that just because I'm in the Silent Generation doesn't mean I can't stop growing and learning. That they're right there alongside. It's very exciting to see all five generations really taking control of their personal and professional development.
So you just busted a stereotype for us that everyone who's in a traditionalist generation would not be interested in career development. Mm-hmm. Delilah, Kim, do you have another stereotype that you think needs to be busted about a certain generation?
Oh, let's see. I think that, you know, with the Silent Generation, there are so many stereotypes, and I think there's probably, because just the numbers are different, so few people to bust them. But I do think one of the things similar to that in terms of professional development, they also want to progress in their career. Mm-hmm. So when someone's in the workplace and they're, you know, of a certain age, managers kind of quickly think of, oh, if there is a new opportunity or a new position on my team, that person's not interested. And, you know, you're only going to talk to the younger people about it. And that person is just not used to communicating it in a way, because the millennial generation is much more vocal about that type of progress. Mm-hmm. So I do think it's not only development, it's also like, okay, that I'm still moving in my career, like I'm not trying to be that solid performer, right, on the 9 grid who never moves, just doing my job, getting my meets expectation, that I really want to be better than that. But in my generation, I haven't necessarily been taught the skills or that it's acceptable to bring that to my manager. Mm-hmm. So I'd agree with that.
That's such a great point. I often think about millennials, I think, want what all generations have always wanted. We just didn't have the tools to speak up. I didn't have ratemyprofessor.com and Glassdoor mm-hmm. and Yelp and Twitter, so mm-hmm. I might have wanted more feedback or more development, but there was nowhere to express that. So I thought, oh, I guess we don't get that.
Right.
And now mm-hmm. I think a lot of us are somewhat envious that millennials are coming up in a time where they have access to all these tools that give them a voice in these kinds of situations.
Which really is great for all of us, right?
Yeah.
So if that makes it safe for everyone to voice their opinions and their career goals, then we all win, right? So we have to remember that too. It's not like every generation only cares if it moves forward.
Yeah. Okay. I absolutely see that in the workplace today. I have just as many baby boomers coming to make an appointment with me to talk about their next career mm-hmm. opportunity and what their career path would be as I have millennials and Gen Zs. So I think it's definitely rubbed off, and everyone sort of realizes now, wait, I can ask that, I can step through that door. I think the millennials have really opened that up for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Kim, how do the millennials adapt and learn from the other generations? You've studied boomers and you've studied millennials, which is mm-hmm. somewhat uncommon. Give us some perspective on what you see as some of the differences and similarities.
I think that, well, can I bust a myth really
yes,
quick first?
Yes, please
I'll just, do. I'm going to do a Gen X one, if that's okay, just because Gen Xers, the like forgotten middle child, I feel like constantly. There you go. Mm-hmm. I think it's sort of entertaining to watch how the millennials get the credit for so many changes that have happened in the workplace, where, and then there's always the Gen Xers sitting around being like, I did that. And I'm like, no, I see you, I get that. it is so true, but it's, I think it's so fun. I mean, funny, I guess, is not totally the right word. But, you know, there's so much talk today about things like work-life balance and flexible work arrangements. And that, I mean, that was a Gen X fight. And Gen Xers were not willing to make some of those same time sacrifices as previous generations. And now there's a lot of interesting data about the impacts of that now that Gen Xers are approaching 50. Lowest divorce rate since the 1950s, significantly less likely than their baby boomer counterparts to get type 2 diabetes. And so impacts on marriage, impacts on health, like that was a Gen X thing. Transparency, less PR massaged messaging, more honesty. I mean, that millennials had a bigger megaphone, but again, that was a Gen X fight. And so I think it's, you know, something just to keep in mind that we all kind of build off of the work of one another. And so I feel like Gen Xers just needed like the shout out that they deserve for the work that they put in that, you know, that's changing things today.
So since we're talking about Gen X.
Yes.
It's funny, I've never thought, I am a true Gen Xer, and I always think it's probably not a coincidence that I study these topics and that so many Gen Xers are interested in this, because just demographically, there are about 76 million boomers born in the United States, only about 55 million Gen Xers. That is a massively smaller generation, about 62 million millennials born. It fluctuates over time, but Xers just kind of never had the numbers to make our voices heard. So the changes that we made, as you said, I mean, many of the Silicon Valley companies, Google, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, Elon Musk, LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, those are all started by Gen Xers. And so Gen X has this impact that is often not promoted. And I think the advantage for those of us who are Xers is I think we are natural remixers. We are naturally multi-generational because we had no choice. We had to speak boomer and we had to speak millennial. It was survival. And so I think that it's true. When you look at, I just gave you a new language. When you look at the generations, we really do have to look at all of them individually. So I really appreciate you bringing Gen X. I'm a Gen Xer and I even forgot to ask about Gen X. So what does that tell you? With that, we are going to bring Kara back up and hand it over to all of you in the audience to ask your questions to our fantastic panel. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm glad you said the forgotten middle child, not the redheaded stepchild. That's what I'm So if you have questions, we have three microphones in the aisles, so please come on, step up, and we'll call you. But we're going to start with just, for our panelists, what is the key takeaway that you want to leave with this audience, that they walk out of this room and that's what they really remember and that's where their impact can be made?
I would say each individual can have a multi-generational experience. So how do you, as an individual, think about yourself having contacts and connections and colleagues of all generations? It's not just about the organization being multi-generational, it's about each of us needing to thrive. So my challenge, my homework to all of you, is at lunch today or next time you walk into a room, sit next to someone of a different generation. Start to build those relationships. It's rarer than we think.
You know, I would definitely say to learn how to lead with empathy. And it's not like that's a psychological trait. Some people are empathetic and some people are not. But if you just start with mapping who your relationships are and then identifying what those gaps are, it just gives you a clean action item of, oh, I really need to know more people like this. So lead with empathy.
Be flexible and be sure to connect one-on-one with your team members.
As they tap into the natural inclination that we have, that we like being together. Like when I interview boomers who have recently retired, I ask them what do they miss most about the workplace, and a lot of them say things like, I miss my like 25-year-old colleagues. I'm never around like kids in their 20s anymore, and I miss their dating stories and all of the funny things. And so I think it's important just to keep in mind that, you know, Fast Company and all of these blogs, they get more clicks when they post something like the millennial and boomer war, or whatever that is, and like that's not really who we are. We like being together, and I think to lean into that natural inclination.
Great. Speaking of leaning in, we'll go ahead with the question in the middle, please.
Elderly gents and a little bit more experienced, but women are often seen as grandmoms in the workplace. So what do you do when you deal with that stereotypical image? You know, they call me the nana nurse because I'm older. And that's okay, it's kind of cute, but it still stereotypes me as older.
Such a great question.
So
I'll start with
on
that.
I
would say
Wait, do you want to repeat the question?
Oh, yeah.
Because her mic wasn't on
yeah.
for the first
so,
part.
Go ahead. So how do we deal with the stereotypes, the difference between men versus women in the older generation? Is that correct interpretation?
The first thing I would say is you talked about sort of having a reputation for it, what I heard was nurturing, right? And so if you, as you think about positions and your career growth and development, think about how you can actually leverage the idea that if you are a nurturing individual, that you can leverage that strength. And then the other thing is leverage your network, right? It's that my experience is, I don't know about everyone in this room, but my secondary network is always the network that is helping me find my next opportunity to shine and achieve. So I might know Delilah, but she knows someone that has the right next position for me. And if I can leverage that network and leverage my strengths, then you have a better opportunity. Does anyone else want to take a...
And I would just say on stereotypes overall, right, we all have stereotypes that work for and against us. And I don't think the message of our panel today is that everybody's living in one big happy family. I think it's that it requires a lot of work for us to move beyond the stereotypes or the generation or whatever label it is. So if you are nurturing, you know, no issue with that. If you're perceived as nurturing just because of your age, then you need to actively address that stereotype. So it's clear to people that you aren't, you know, you aren't what they assume. Mm-hmm. But yeah, stereotypes are very hard to deal with, but we all definitely have to break through those barriers and get help from people unlike you.
You know, to that point, because I do a lot of focus grouping, and I'll talk about this issue particularly with millennials and Gen Zs, it's actually somewhat frequent that a young person will say, I didn't know that offended you. I was trying to be nice, or I was trying to mm-hmm. bond with you to say that you remind me of my grandmother. And but genuinely. So I think a really kind of honest, kind, coaching conversation to say, you know, actually, I'd prefer that we didn't say that, or this is how it makes me feel. I think you might be surprised mm-hmm. sometimes that someone isn't even aware. Sometimes it's deliberate, and it's demeaning, and it's terrible, and ageism is real. And sometimes I think it also could be a coachable conversation.
I'll just say it. There's a great book that came out called Women Rowing North. It's by Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. She's a psychologist. Some of you might be familiar. And she does a lot of research around the difference between how men and women age. And just based on data, I mean, women are crushing it, and things are like a little bit more dire for men. So just based on numbers. And so I would look at that. I mean, if you have an analytical team and you know they're interested in these kinds of topics, mm-hmm. so it's one way to address it.
Great, thank you.
Next question over here.
Hi, I'm a millennial by Pew definitions, but mostly get identified as a Gen Xer because I get complained to a lot about those millennials where I'm then able to be very candid and say I'm actually a millennial too. So can we reframe that conversation? But I'm having this interesting thought as I'm sitting here. I probably need to go back and talk to some of my newer employees who are coming right out of college, usually into their first career with me and on my team. And I'm realizing I don't just need to align their expectations, but my expectations and my leadership team's expectation about how they work in the workplace, right? So we can all be successful. So strategy is about not just aligning maybe their expectations, but everyone's expectations across those teams so that we're all gonna have to bend and be flexible, I think, so they're successful and we're successful. So maybe some points around that, please.
I think you're exactly right. One of the tricks and tactics I always talk about is to be very explicit, right? That this is our expectation that there are really no promotions before 2 years, or this is when you will hear from me, this is when you'll receive feedback. So if you actually discuss those things openly, it's a conversation as opposed to the secret fantasy on one side that you're going to get promoted after 6 months and this honest conversation on the other side. So I had one millennial sit next to me on an airplane. Never tell anyone on an airplane that you're a career coach because it turns into a 3.5-hour career coaching session. And he said to me, I want to get promoted. I'm gunning it. I'm working really hard. I'm a millennial. I want to move forward. I want to move fast. And my boss keeps telling me, calm down. Your career is a marathon, not a sprint. Mm-hmm. And he said, fine. Just tell me what mile I'm on. Give me some information.
because his boss kept saying slow down, and he said I want to go faster, but nobody was actually saying what that meant. And so if you actually say, to me moving fast means a year, and you said, well, to me moving slow means a year and a half, that's a different conversation than 10 years and 1 year. So I think specifics and a little bit of transparency can go a long way. Sometimes we keep people's own career paths most secret from them, and people really want to know. So I think a little more transparency, 5% in each direction closer, can go a long way. Thank you.
Great. On to the question over here.
Hi, thank you. So one way companies are introducing this transparency and inclusivity is resource groups, specifically young professional resource groups. I know GSK has one. I recently started one at LabCorp. And I was wondering if you could speak to the efficacy of those groups, maybe pros and cons. And secondly, I've worked to connect young professional resource groups across my industry, and I've noticed that overwhelmingly the leaders and the founders are women. I was wondering if you had any insight as to why that is.
I mean, I would say, I think if you look at employee resource groups across the board, the leaders and founders are women. I think women tend to focus on the other cultural aspects of the workplace more often than not. Women's ERGs often tend to be the larger ones because the numbers sort of benefit them as well. And they'll then be a champion for whatever diverse segment wants to open that up. At Comcast, we have one, a young professionals network. And I think, you know, like anything else, and one ERG is not going to solve everybody's issues. One common sort of myth is that if I join the young professionals group, does that mean I'm young in my career or young in my age, because my needs are different? And so the group has to sort of decide who are they targeting. All ERGs are open to every member, but you want to understand which experiences and expectations are you trying to cater to and what that looks like. So one of the initiatives I work with our young professional group on is securing board seats. So I have some experience, I'm getting to a manager position, I'd love to understand what that looks like outside of the workplace in terms of nonprofit board seats. And so that's something very specific that we work on together that brings together people beyond sort of age and where you are in your career. But I do think a lot of times, whoever is founding that initial leadership group, who are you targeting? Am I really targeting people my age or my level in my career? And how do I communicate that?
So I think we can sneak in one more question right here.
Hi, good morning. One of the issues facing my company today, and I know a lot of other companies as well, is adoption of technology. And I'd really love to hear your thoughts and perspective from research or from your own business perspectives on methods and different strategies for effectively adopting new technologies. You know, we're asking our employees to use a lot of new tools, and everybody has different skill sets and levels. We're also perhaps launching new products and things like that for our customers, and so we're asking them to adopt new technologies along with us so that we can sort of stay ahead of the curve and find the right balance and the right tools to become the most productive as an organization. So really love to hear your thoughts on that.
Go ahead.
A quick example from a company I worked with was they had technology ambassadors when they had new software rollouts that were deliberately multi-generational. And they were people who wore t-shirts that said, have a question about Salesforce, ask me. And it allowed people to say, well, I feel a little bit more comfortable asking somebody of my generation, or I don't feel comfortable asking this person. It created an environment where people had others to talk to who made them feel comfortable. They also realized that people were going to adopt in different time frames. So it wasn't that people were not capable of doing it. It's just that some generations or some individuals might be able to take the technology much quicker than others, and they had to expand the time frame that they gave people to adapt. So I think making lots of different people available for teaching and guiding, as well as altering the time frames for different individuals.
I was just going to add, I mean, one example we talk a lot about at Comcast is the adoption of our voice remote. I don't know how many Comcast customers are in the room, but it originally started as a project of how to make it easier for somebody who might not be physically mobile, but obviously it's a benefit that can work for lots of different people. And when we find customers who aren't using it, it usually is because they don't know the specific application that matters to them. It turns out that most people use it to change the channel. That's like the number one thing that people use on their voice remote, which wasn't an initial selling point, but because different focus groups sort of said, hey, this is what really matters to me versus show me everything about, you know, historically black colleges and universities. It's usually that, you know, what is the benefit? You know, it's just like you're selling anything else. And does your customer see that as a benefit as well?
Yeah. And just to build off of that, the tying it to the customer, I think, is something that is really important. And in healthcare, if any of you work in healthcare, this is something that comes up a lot with the rollout of electronic medical records. And there were a lot of older professionals where they were accustomed to a lot more of that face-to-face. The fact that there was a computer in the room felt incredibly invasive. But I think that over time, as there's been more of an explanation of how electronic medical records save lives, how making sure that people have access to their own healthcare records actually fundamentally changes this entire experience, changes patient outcome. There was much more adoption after that because healthcare workers, for example, that's what they care about the most, is patient outcome. And so the more that they could tie the messaging around tech to how this actually impacts patients, the more buy-in they could get.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the questions. Sorry, we didn't have time to cover them all, but thank you also, Kim, Nicole, Delilah, and Lindsay. Lindsay's going to head out to the bulk signing. So thanks, guys. Have a great rest of your day.